Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor Scoot McNairy. If Scoot McNairy hadn't found acting, it's possible he'd be mowing lawns for a living. Scoot grew up relishing the outdoors of his native Texas and started his own landscaping company at age 13 to make some spending money. Towards the end of high school, he had some thinking to do about his future. Since he was severely dyslexic, college seemed out of the question. So one day his father asked, "What's the one thing that you could do every single day that would get you up and out of bed that would make you want to go to work?" Scoot's answer, being on a movie set. Aside from being outdoors, Scoot's other great passion was watching movies. He was fascinated by the magic of it all. And as a kid who loved to take things apart, he wanted to know how everything worked. He decided to move to Los Angeles for film school, but got relatively little out of it and felt like he needed the hands-on experience of a movie set. Scoot's fastest way in was getting work as a background actor, often more ingloriously referred to as an extra. As he says, "I swear I learned more in 2 weeks as a background actor on the practice than I did in the entire year I went to film school." Well, background work turned to commercial work, which eventually turned to acting in television and film, thanks to an acting teacher who politely kicked him out of class so he'd start auditioning for roles instead of compulsively going to class. Because of his unconventional education, he approaches his job from a unique angle, creating very real and emotional performances in projects like Halt and Catch Fire, True Detective, Narcos, and the upcoming Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Scoot joins off camera to talk about the dark place he had to live in to embody his True Detective character, how growing up with a learning disability helped him embrace failure, and why the only time his heart beats at a normal rate is on a motorcycle. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Scoot.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, listen, I've wanted to have you on for a long time, and after doing a little research, I really wanted to have you on to confirm that you ride dirt bikes, because I need more dirt bike friends.
I need more dirt bike friends, too. I hear that you're quite into the motos, dirt bikes, or just, are you on the street at all?
Not only, if I want to go get tacos and the police won't catch me.
A grocery getter bike.
That's right.
There you go.
Did you ride as a kid?
Yeah, I did. My uncle, we had this farm or ranch out in Paris, Texas, and he raced for Harley-Davidson, like, back in the 60s. And my father was really into horses, so my uncle had bought all these, you know, small, like, XR75s, CR80s,
yeah,
smaller bikes for the kids, and my dad had bought all these horses. I say all these horses. We had about 6 or 7 horses. And I think around the time I was 8, my cousin Barbara loved horses, and I traded my paint Geronimo for my cousin Barbara's XR75. And so you can have the horse if I can have the bike. And then from there out, I was just, on motorcycles. I didn't even know how to shift gears or use the clutch. And my father would get on the back of it, get me going in first gear, and then hop off. And I remember I was going down a dirt road, and my uncle comes yelling out, "You got to shift gears," because I was probably running it, at 9,000 RPMs. And I remember specifically the day when I switched into second gear and felt the wind, and then to third, and then down this dirt road. And I must have been 8 years old, maybe only going 40 miles an hour, but to me it just felt like 100. And from there out, I was hooked.
Really?
Yeah, from there out, it was my love. I'd ride journal about motorcycles and, buy all the magazines and motorcycles.
Would you say that you were the kid that you did it because that's how you needed to get your, to get your kicks, or did you love the sport, or?
It was more so the freedom to be able to, as a kid, to go far distances.
Right.
Which inevitably when I turned, I had a bicycle, and we would, me and my friends growing up, we would ride those bicycles 10, 15, 20 miles a day and not think twice about it. But when I got my license, when I turned 16, I just started peeling out to the outskirts of Texas. And I just remember that freedom that I have this vehicle that can take me as far as that I want to go, and I can go wherever I want, and I can go by myself, And I don't know what it was. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it was a sense of freedom and sense of no one can tell me no. You know, no one can tell me I can't go there. I could just go there. I had the means to do it. I feel like some people, every individual has their own out or escape or something, but you don't really realize it until it's taken from you, or you break a leg and you can't ride. A perfect example, I've been on a job that I haven't had my bikes for 6 months, and I'm feeling this.
What job was that?
I'm shooting a Narcos.
Oh yeah, right.
TV show right now down in Mexico, and it feels, I'm assuming, kind of like when the surfer doesn't have the waves. You know what I mean? And I'm feeling this sort of emptiness that I just need. I mean, even 10 minutes.
Right.
Just 10 minutes to just go and not think about anything. Or, I mean, you know, the riding bikes really clears your head. There's such an immense focus.
Yeah.
That you can't think about something else. And this focus allows you to just, it's like a meditation that just clears your head.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because right before we started filming, you mentioned that on the bike is the only time when your heart beats at a normal rate.
Yeah, when I was, you know, heading to all these auditions when I was living out here, and, you know, commercial auditions and guest, whatever they were, I found myself, my mouth would get dry. I had to bring water into the room and take sips in between the scenes, and my heart rate would just be racing, just beating out of my chest. But then I would notice on the way there, I'd be doing, you know, 100, 105 down the 101 to the 405, and I'd check in with my body, and I was like, why is my heart just calm right now? And then I get off of it, and the second I walk into a building and sign in, it's like I'm terrified, you know? And I don't know what the relationship between the two of them were. It was that immense focus, as well as when you're hungover. You can be hungover and you get on that bike and the hangover goes away and you feel great for an hour and you get off and all of a sudden the hangover comes right back. It was, I don't know what it is.
Well, I agree with you. There's a focus there that, especially like when you're trying to do something difficult on a bike, you can't think about anything else. It requires all of your, and there's something, I guess, very peaceful about that, that if you don't do it, you don't understand that.
Yeah, or the idea that it's not fun unless you can die doing it.
Do you think that's a part of it for you?
Maybe, but I do find myself having more fun at things that there's a potential chance you could really injure yourself.
Right.
Makes it so much more exciting.
See, I find that fascinating that you gravitate towards things like that, and yet an acting audition can bring you such massive anxiety.
Yeah, it feels like there's such a... In the audition, I feel like auditioning and acting are two complete different industries. They're two different businesses, two different professions. You know, I don't think I ever really fully grasped or got confident with the audition process. To me, it was so bizarre. I was tangible things, or being able to have a set and a world and materials and objects to play with and frames to play in, for me, was completely different than walking into a room where, you know, I had to audition for Nacho Libre and the...
How old were you then? That was a while ago.
I don't know. I don't...
20s?
You're probably in my late 20s or something, but I remember walking into the room and the couch in the casting room was like a foot from the desk, and it was like a wrestling scene, and I was just like, this is impossible. Like, how do you do this? But, you know, if I were to get the job, you know, you'd go to Nacho, you'd have a whole ring to play around in, so... I feel like the audition process and the actual process of being on set or a stage is just completely different.
Now, you completed filming recently for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm. Quentin Tarantino. Did you have to audition for him?
Yes.
You did?
Absolutely.
Tell me about that.
I was working on a show, True Detective, in Arkansas.
Yeah.
And there was nobody to record me, to put myself on tape. So I had an old cell phone, and I recorded all the lines on this cell phone with the beats, the space in between, and then I put it on my little speakers, and I set my cell phone up to film me. And then I would...
Oh, wait a minute. You recorded the dialogue.
It's me talking to myself.
And yes, you put in gaps between...
Between the lines. And so it's me talking, it's my voice on both sides, but it's just a speaker. That was the only way I had to do it. And then I realized after that, because I ended up getting the job, that why do I ever call anybody to put me on tape? I can just put myself on tape with myself.
But didn't that take a while to figure out, like, how long of a space you needed between each?
No, because that's how I learn lines. You know, I record myself and leave beats in between. And then, so I can sit there and run lines over and over and over and over and over and not inconvenience anyone.
So you kind of memorize the other character.
I memorize everyone's lines.
You do?
I mean, not by choice, just from my process of memorizing my own lines, I inevitably memorize everyone else's lines too.
Do you ever give them a line if they forget it?
I try to never do that, but I have, you know what I mean? If, you know, I try not to never, ever, ever do that, but,
yeah. So once you sent your tape in, was there a second audition process? Did you have to go in a room with him? And
no, which I don't know if this is true or not, but when I got the job, I hadn't met him yet and hadn't gone to a callback or anything. He just booked me from the tape that I sent in. He said that to me on set. He said, "You're the first person that I've ever cast that I didn't meet before I cast him." And then he said to me, "Do you remember what you did in the... on the tape?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Nothing." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "That's what I want you to do, is nothing."
Were you doing nothing?
I mean, to me, I watched a lot of Bruce Dern.
Okay.
From back in his older stuff, in the Westerns and stuff. And I liked the simplicity of Bruce. And so I sort of was like, you know, let me take what Bruce is doing from those times and be, you know, subtle, I guess is the word. And I think that maybe that's what maybe Quentin saw the subtlety of it, and that was it. And then, you know, obviously working with Quentin is like he is the show. You know, watching him hold court on set is the most entertaining thing I've probably ever experienced in this industry.
When you say that, what picture comes to mind?
Him just walking around, dropping, he's an encyclopedia. But he knows the guy that had one line in a guest star on some show from 1961 that only aired for one season. You know, and he's telling a whole story about this guy and why this guy was so great. And I just, you know, anybody that thinks they know about film and movies, I mean, put them in a room with that guy and it's just like you feel like you don't know anything about anything.
Is that an intimidating thing, or by the time you're there on set, do you feel like you belong?
I never got the anxiety at work. It was just the auditions. At work, you can fail and fail and fail. And I love that part about working on a project, is you get to fail every take if you want. Or not if you want. You have the ability, it's okay if you fail. And so I think some of the best stuff comes out of failures, you know, and making mistakes. It's one thing I usually say before a take, let's make some mistakes.
Really?
Because the mistakes aren't planned and they're genuine and they're real. And I personally believe that if it's real, nobody can argue it.
See, that is a statement you can't apply to riding motorcycles.
Yes. Maybe that's the juxtaposition that I like.
You do not
so much
get on the bike and look over your buddies and go, let's make some mistakes.
Let's make some mistakes, no.
Well, that's fascinating, because if I put myself in those shoes, I would worry that I wanted to succeed sort of right off, to take the pressure off before we get to making those mistakes. And I would just wonder how you get to that level when you've wanted to do this for a long time and you get there and not have some self-critical voice in there.
The one thing I feel like I've been good at is knowing that once a take is done, it's in concrete and there's nothing you can do about it. So it doesn't exist to me. You walk away and you get another chance. And I guess that's maybe stems from I don't ever look backwards, I only look forwards. I grew up dyslexic, and went to a really big school, called the Shelton School of Dallas.
Okay.
And so they don't tell you that you're dumb or, I mean, anything. Obviously, it's the school, but it's called a learning difference. So there is, as a young kid, you do realize that you're different. And so there was a sense of, like, it's almost like I kind of thought that I was going to fail. Like, that's what failure is you're different, I'm different than these other people. How come I can't go to their school? I want to go to public school with my friends, and I'm over at this other school. But the process of someone telling you you're not good enough or in an audition or you're not, to me, never bothered me. I was so used to that as a child, not being not good enough. So when someone told me out here, like, you didn't get the part because you weren't good enough, I was, all right, well, I'll go to the next one. Maybe I'll be good there.
So at what age did you sort of discover that there was a problem with learning?
I didn't. I think I couldn't sit still in second grade. I always leaned back in my chair, and I would fall a lot. And I'm sure there was other things, but that was the thing I remember was the final straw was the day I fell back in my chair, and my desk fell back, and it was this desk with all your stuff in there, and all the stuff fell out of it. And I just remember sometime after that, I was put into all these testing centers where they would put all these puzzles underneath you. I mean, puzzles for days. Puzzles, what would you do with this puzzle? What would you do with that puzzle? And then they'd take them away and give
you. And was this your parents doing this, or was this the school?
No, it was the parents trying to figure out what it is, like, what's wrong. You know, dyslexia and ADHD and all that stuff wasn't really, there wasn't that much knowledge on it at the time, and this is around the late 80s. And then I got moved from these testing centers, and then all of a sudden I was at this new school in third grade.
Oh, really? So that young?
Yeah, in third grade, and we were doing all these random things, moving jawbreakers in ice trays with tweezers into different ones, and they watch how you separate them. Do you separate them by color? Do you separate them by size? Math books were, if you were really good at math, you could fly through the yellow book, the green book, the purple book, and the orange book. But if you weren't, you could stay on the yellow book from third grade to fourth grade to fifth grade. I mean, they figured out what you excel in and what you don't excel in. And when they figure out what you do excel in, they put more of that stuff underneath you. And they figure out if you're a kinetic learner, you learn with your, you know, do you learn by touching things? Do you learn with your eyes or do you learn with your ears? And once they figure that out, they just focus on that, and they learn that I don't learn anything by touching or hearing. I learn everything with my eyes. I.e., I could watch someone take apart an engine once and remember how to put it back together.
But you couldn't take the manual.
I could never read the manual. It would never happen. I can drive one place once and never need a map to get there again. You know, I just remember everything. I mean, even on my paper, my sides, or my script, I'll put symbols all over it, like triangles and squares and lines and stuff. And
so what do those correspond to?
It's a visual memory that if I don't know the lines, I can see right next to you all the patterns and the dialogue and the symbols and stuff. And so it's
really?
Yeah.
So if you got a big chunk of lines, you put a triangle next to it.
No, I put all they're all in between there. There'll be triangles there, a square here, a line here. I make a imprint of it. It's bizarre. Some people look at it like, what is all these symbols and stuff all over there? And they don't mean anything. They're just something to photographically memorize it.
That's amazing. So when you were a kid and you were taking in all this new ways of learning and you're in this new school, what was the internal messaging in terms of you were with your friends and now you're not? And like, what would you tell yourself about what was going on with you?
Well, the great thing was I was in this other school, but I grew up in this neighborhood that was sort of a phenomenon. It was six blocks, and there was a child in every single house over the course of 140 homes. And we had a creek that ran right through the middle of this neighborhood. So every kid was either between the age of 2 and like 15. And I would go to school, but every day when I came home, At Shelton, they didn't give you any much homework because all the learning was done at the school.
Right.
You take your book bag, throw it in the house, and you were down at the creek. And you were down at the creek with 15, 20 other kids.
So did you consider yourself like, oh, I have a learning disability, or did you think you weren't smart or any of that stuff?
No, I didn't. It didn't bother me or concern me. It was nothing that like sort of, oh, something that weighed on me I carried with the rest of my life. I didn't think too much about it because all I thought about was getting out of school and going down the creek.
Really?
Yeah, that was where my playground was. That's where that's the only thing I cared about in life was getting down to that creek and hanging out with my buddies and going fishing and, chewing tobacco for the first time or having your first beer and just exploring. I mean, the creek was massive. I mean, it was endless.
So when you went to the ranch, would you spend a lot more time alone and then you'd come back and...
No, I got a two older brother, a little brother, a little sister, and my two cousins, Barbara and Kate. So it was the six of us out there. And there was plenty to do. We'd go fishing, a lot of fishing, ride horses. And our parents took us out there to get a break. So they kind of saddle up the horse or get out the motorcycle and gas it up and be like, you're on your own. And now that I have kids, constantly yelling at my daughter, watch out for snakes, watch out for snakes. And we just saw so many snakes out there. It's a miracle none of us ever got bit. And it's a miracle that my parents just let us, go out into the...
Right.
You know what I mean? There was so many things that could have hurt us back out there, and they just... I mean, yeah, it was a great way to grow up. And obviously you don't realize that later until you grow up and meet other people and see what their childhood was like or how they grew up. But I feel very, very lucky to have had those outdoor experiences and that nature and stuff that I think still is with me, now or today.
Hey folks, let's take a short break from the conversation so I can tell you about this week's sponsor, Boosted. Now, don't fast forward this message because I want to tell you all about Boosted. You probably know if you listen to this show regularly that I'm a skateboarder and that I like to do fast, fun things that add a little excitement to my life every day. One of the things we do around here at Off Camera is we take off around the neighborhood either to go get lunch or just to take a break from work. And I do that on a skateboard or a bike. And recently I've been doing it on a Boosted board. We have both a longboard and a mini here, and they are so fun. Now, I've been a skateboarder my whole life, but our producer, Crawford, has not been a skateboarder, and it's wild to see the look of joy and excitement on his face as we cruise down the street on these boards. And I mention that because I think some people hear electric skateboard and they think, uh-oh, this is a bad idea. But the thing is, it's super easy to ride, it's super stable, and it's really, really fun. In fact, my 12-year-old daughter got on it the other day, and she was cruising around in no time. So if you haven't checked these things out, you've got to try them. We're in Santa Monica, where there's every option in the world, from buses and trains to scooters and rental bikes, and the most fun way we've discovered of getting around town is on a Boosted board. Instead of sitting in traffic, searching for parking, or dealing with a smelly seatmate on the bus, you can imagine riding these streets, the wind in your hair, on your own Boosted electric vehicle. Boosted's vehicle-grade electric skateboards and scooters are the modern solution to your transportation woes. With a 22-mile range and max speeds of 24 miles an hour, Boosted is perfect for both running to the store and traveling across town. Designed to provide a luxurious experience, it's no wonder that Boosted was one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. With five options to pick from, including their new scooter, the Boosted Rev, there's a personal electric vehicle that's tailor-made for you. Starting at $61 a month with financing, there's no better time to change how you move than now. So right now, Boosted is offering our listeners $75 off the purchase of an electric vehicle when you use the code CAMERA at checkout. Go to boostedboards.com and use the code CAMERA at checkout to get $75 off your vehicle. That's boostedboards.com, promo code CAMERA, at checkout for $75 off. Now back to the show.
When did you sort of, like when you were in high school, did you have sort of thoughts of what you're going to do with your life, what your plan was? I mean, did you have a spark of a performer in you, or a moment where you're like, oh, maybe?
I think I might have been like a class clown or whatnot, but I mean, I love the outdoors, and so I loved, you know, I had a landscaping company when I was 13, 12 or 13.
Really?
Yeah, I wanted money, and I remember my dad would give me like 10 bucks every Friday, you know, and I'd go up to the magic store or go to the comic book store or something and get some, or baseball card store and get some baseball cards. But I was like, I want 20. And he was like, well, you know, you get 10. That's all you get. And I was like, I was at a very young age. I was like, well, how do I make more money? And he was like, well, and I was like, I want to can I mow the yard? And he was like, well, no, you're going to cut your toes off. Can't do that. And so I figured out how to start the mower and got the mower started and mow the yard. And then he's like, okay, you can mow the yard. I'll give you 20 bucks to mow the yard. And then I learned, oh, if he'll give me 20 bucks, let the neighbors give me 20 bucks. So I had like 10 lawns at like 13, 14 years old, just in the neighborhood. And I would put the blower and the extension cord and the bags and everything on the mower and the weed eater. And then I'd start the mower up and use that to push all the stuff around the neighborhood. And so after, you know, years of that, you always turn 16 and you get your driver's license and you get a trailer, and then it was full on. So I thought I was going to go into like horticulture or landscaping. And my dad asked me that. He's like, you know, I think he knew I wasn't really going to go to college and didn't have much interest in it. And he said, hey, you know, maybe I could help you out with getting your landscaping company a little bigger. And that was the first time I had to really think of like, well, man, hold on. Like, I never thought about that. I don't know if that's what I want to do for the rest of my life. And he asked me a question that he said, I don't want you to answer, to think about it. And he was like, what would be the one thing that you could do every morning? There's nothing that could keep you in bed. You just want to get up and go to work. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I thought about it. And with my dyslexia, I didn't connect to reading. So I didn't read at all as a kid. But I watched tons of movies. And that was like reading a book to me. And I loved movies. I loved the magic of them. And it was just something that was like, how do they do that? Like, how do they make that car fly? Or how do they crash that car? How is this magic happening? I wanted to know how it worked. And I said to him, I could go to a movie set every day. And I would never sleep and I'd go to a movie set. And he said, well, what else would you like to do?
He was like, that's not going to happen.
Not that. But at the time, I was thinking I'd be happy just holding a cord and just watching to see how it worked. I wanted to know how it worked. And my parents were really good about, they realized at a young age, too, that I just didn't want to sleep. And they let me stay in the garage as long as the garage door was closed for as late as I wanted to. And I had all these tools and stuff that my granddad had given my mom. And just stuff out there, and I would take apart stuff and just mess with stuff, and they didn't, you know, sometimes I'd go to bed at midnight and stuff. And so even to this day, I still feel like I'm always sort of sitting with the cameraman, looking at all the new gear, looking at all the toys, looking at the techno crane.
So how did that become like the thing you could pursue? Like, because from what I read, it sounded like you didn't initially go to film school to learn how to act, you went to learn how to, like,
Be a DP,
a cameraman.
I was fascinated or interested in photography and the outdoors. So I think I was working up in British Columbia at this place. I was a ski boat driver, and I signed a contract to be a glacier guide, you know, and they were about to go into training. Yeah, but they had to train me for that, and then the following year you'd be a glacier guide. And there was this black rock. It was like, you know, 150 feet high or something. I didn't know that. It just looked like a little black rock. And they said, whatever you do on your day off, don't go to the black rock. On the first day of my day off, I went out to the black rock, climbed up to the top of it, jumped off, and shattered a couple vertebrae and slipped some discs. So I got flown to the hospital, long story. And anyways, I got let go from the job. And that was the first time I had to realize, well, that's what I was going to do. I was going to be a glacier guide or an outdoors, something living in the woods. And then I thought, okay, I'll go to film school in Los Angeles and I'll learn how to be a cinematographer and then I can go be a wildlife cinematographer. And it wasn't really till I got down here.
To LA.
To LA I was going to film school. I was doing a year of it, and I wasn't learning anything. And I remember my teacher saying, the best way to learn film is to be on set. And so I thought, well, how do you get on set? And then I knew you could do background work. So
like extras.
Yeah, so I registered with Central Casting and started doing background work. But I was working on The Practice as a background. And, you know, they shovel all the background actors out to holding.
Right.
But I'd try and stick around. And this one camera guy noticed that I was sticking around. And he kind of came over to me and said, you could stick around, but just stay out of the way. And I was like, okay. And I just sat there and watched. And I swear, I learned more in that 2 weeks that I was a background actor on The Practice than I did in the year I went to film school. And then I got a job at this carpentry place as a carpenter building these sets for this event planning company. And next door was a guy who owned a floral department for the event planning company. And we would smoke cigarettes on our breaks. And he had a friend named John Pierce, who is still my manager today. I've been working with him for 20 years. And he said, he's got a little boutique commercial agency, and do you want to bartend at his Christmas party? I said, sure. And I bartended his Christmas party, and his clients were saying, you should do commercials. And I said, sure, you know, whatever. And I came back to him after the holidays, came in there, and he was like, no, you're not an actor. You're not going to do commercials. But the guy from the floral department called him and said, come on, take him, you know, send him out on some commercials. Anyways, I booked a commercial in my first month for Marshalls. And all I had to do was walk out of a house. It's for Mother's Day, kiss this lady on the cheek, give her a hug, walk off. And I made more money on that commercial than I made my entire year as a carpenter. And I got another job 2 months later. And then that was it. I was 22.
And you just started doing commercials.
Still wasn't focused on acting. And I was scratching my head saying, this isn't going to last forever. Like, I need to think about my future and what I mean? Like, this is...
So did you see yourself as an actor then?
I was working commercials. I was kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing. I have no clue.
Had you ever taken an acting class?
No, not really. But at 26, I was like, if I'm going to do this, I should figure out what I'm doing. And I took all that money I made in commercials and took an acting class probably 2-3 days a week for 3 years straight.
Really?
Took from everyone. Everyone. I mean, once I heard a teacher repeat herself after 6 months, I'd be like, I think I know everything that she's offering. I'm off and we'll go to somebody else. And I was at this one lady, Susan Batson.
Okay.
And she saw me in class all the time. And she's like, do you audition? I said, no. And she goes, you come to class more than any kid I have coming into class. I think you're ready. I don't want to see you in class anymore. And so in a nice way, sort of kicked me out.
Hey folks, let's take a little break from the conversation so I could tell you about this week's sponsor, Snow. You know, everyone wants their home to look and feel great. Luckily, Snow makes it incredibly simple. They create trend-proof, beautiful, functional pieces made for how you live. Whether you just got the keys to your first place or you're looking to upgrade the pieces you've had forever, Snow has home goods that are practical and striking to look at. Snow makes luxury essentials for every room in your home, minus the markup. They partner directly with master craftsmen to create beautiful, simple products that are made to last, like their incredibly soft, award-winning sheets and fluffy duvets, or luxurious air-spun cotton towels and robes. And I will say I have all those things, and they are all wonderful. I sleep on these Snow sheets every night, and they are soft, they're luxurious, they're cool to the touch, and they just get it right. They also have super durable dishwasher-safe porcelain dinnerware and wine glasses with titanium enforced stems. Snow has received rave reviews from Vogue, Fast Company, Apartment Therapy, and more. It's the home collection of your dreams, priced for your reality. And right now, Snow is offering our listeners $30 off your first purchase of $150 or more when you go to snowhome.com/camera. That's snowehome.com/camera to get $30 off your first order. Again, visit snowhome.com/camera for your special offer. Now back to the show.
You know, there's this film that I didn't know about until I started researching, and It's called In Search of a Midnight Kiss, mm-hmm. and you were the lead in it. That must have been right around the time when you were...
2006.
2006.
Yeah.
And in it, you play an out-of-work actor in L.A., and you write this letter to an ex-girlfriend, and you describe that, you know, you moved out to L.A., but you crashed your car on the way here, and you're out of work, and you're broke, and you don't know anybody, and it's lonely. And it got me thinking, like, you know, this is the story that many actors actually have when they come to L.A., and I wondered how autobiographical that letter was, and... You know, if you had some low points in L.A. too, where you were kind of lost and not knowing what you were doing, and if you were, you know what I mean?
Like, yes.
How autobiographical that story was.
I mean, it couldn't have been. It was the actual true story of the filmmaker, Alex Holdridge. That
okay.
was his actual life, and he sort of wrote it almost verbatim. He did crash his car on the way out. He did have all these struggles, but... What I experienced in 2000 or 2001 when I moved out here, 2000, was very, you know, exactly the same, very similar. I mean, I remember just being broke and I had to move into my car and...
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was like this kind of...
How long was that for?
Only for like 2 months, 2.5 months.
Where would you park?
I would keep all my stuff in my car and then I, you know, there was a... friend Julianne who had this house in Venice Beach and there was a fold-out couch in the backyard and I'd stay there sometimes, stayed over at this other person's couch. I was couch surfing more so than living in my car, but I just didn't have any money. And God, I remember thinking, I just need a place. And I found this awful place behind the Magic Castle that was just... And I remember the guy walking out, and I said, hey, is there any place for rent around here? Because there's no rent signs. He's like, yeah, I think they're renting this place. He gave me the number. I met the Chews. The Chews was like, we'll rent it to you for $500. I borrowed $500 from my buddy, rented the place, and I had this candy apple that I kept in my car, and all this dry, like, crackers and stuff and fruit because you didn't need a refrigerator. And I remember I kept this candy apple going, when I get a place, I'm going to eat this candy apple. And I remember getting that place. I took a shower in there. I didn't have any stuff. And I just laid on that hardwood floors naked and just ate that candy apple and just said to myself, like, I don't ever want to go broke again. Like, that was one of the hardest times of my life. And I'm going to work my ass off for the rest of my life so that I don't ever have to be in that place again. And, I don't know, I think that I chalk up to a lot to where I've gotten is from relentless hard work. I mean, like, relentless. And also doing whatever, like having no ego about commercials or short film or...
Yeah.
Like, work is work to me. And I think you start picking your projects when you have two going at the same time. You know, other than that, like, work is work. I mean, we all have movies that we're like, oh, I can't believe I did that movie. And I'm like, I absolutely can believe I did that movie because I wasn't doing anything else. You know
right.
what I mean? It was either that, sitting at home, or do this short film.
So where were your parents in the narrative when you're keeping your stuff in your car and you're trying to get work in L.A.?
I think that was part of it. I think I remember finding that place and calling my mom or my dad and saying, can I borrow $500? I found this place. And I think that was the turning point. If they were like, no. Like, no, you can't borrow any money. Like, this is life. You know, welcome. No. And it was a tough moment, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I just realized I'm never going to ask for a dollar from anybody for the rest of my life. You know what I mean? I'm going to work for it. You know. But with that being said, my parents were great parents. They're supportive, and maybe that's why they said no, is because they knew that this is the best thing that could ever happen to him.
Did your dad think, like, did you get the sense that he thought this was a pipe dream?
Yeah, he did. He vocalized to me that, you know, when I started doing the commercials, he was like, oh, I was like, well, I'm going to be an actor. He's like, but son, like, what are you going to do to make a living? I said, I'll act. He said, son, nobody makes a living acting. You know, it's just not going to happen. You know, and that's another thing that really fueled me as a kid. If someone told me I couldn't do something, I would just about kill myself proving to them that I could.
Just to jump back into this for a minute, when did you become aware that dyslexia was a thing? And was it the same thing where you were like, I'm not going to let this stop me?
What sort of, I think, dawned on me about the dyslexia is that you weren't dumb. I mean, no one ever told you that. But you think differently. And I think the thinking differently is something that I realized is a virtue. Is I looked at it as something that was holding me back for so long that I'm different and I'm not like everyone else. And then over time, I think I switched it over to, oh, I think differently about a way to get something done or a way to do something or creatively than some of these other people. That's a positive. That's not a negative. That's a, the way I see it may be the way only three other people on this job or on this project or trying to figure out this equation, whatever, see it. You know, and that's a, let me speak up. Let me speak up and say, I have an idea. You know, I don't know if my idea works or not, but, and you find yourself a lot like having really hard times verbalizing what your idea is, or, because I'm not very good with words. So that was a challenge. But I don't know, I think I just started using my learning differences as just maybe verbalizing, you know, speaking up more and not being so internal.
It's still fascinating that you picked a profession where verbalizing is the method of communication to impart a story or an emotion or, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, like, I never thought I would go this far when I started this. This is all bonus. I've been in the bonus round for like almost 10 years.
I get the sense that you kind of just keep your own counsel on a lot of stuff. Like you figured out your own method of how something works and you know what I mean? I don't get the sense that when you want to make a decision, you ask a bunch of people's opinion.
You know, and like that's with acting. You know, is someone like, what's your process? Like, who do you know? I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have a process. Every job and role is, I don't know. I get the job. I don't know where to start. I don't have like when you get the job, you start here and write this down and then you do this and you do that. You just sort of start somewhere.
In thinking of True Detective, was that an offer?
No.
No, so you auditioned for that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm curious about that as it relates to your own mystery about your process, because in it you play a parent's worst nightmare role and that your kids go missing. And from all I've read and from what I understand, you had to go to a pretty dark place in terms of imagining losing your own children as a way to understand this character. And that's the method you chose.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if that was the only way you could do it.
I guess it's the only way I feel like I tapped into something. We do these exercises in Susan's class where you had to close your eyes and think of this person in your life that's really in your life, and you had to reach out and touch their cheekbones and touch their face and touch their beard and, you know, or their face and their arms and stuff, and you really had to internalize and focus on them. And I connected with that. I really connected with that and was able to, I feel like, excel once I learned how to do that. So since then, everything, every character has been somebody that I know.
Really?
So as much as I say, oh, I'm gonna make this character up, it stems from someone that I knew or met. And if I don't know him or meet him, I'll go out and find him. True Detective, the exterior of that character I went out and found. What the guy looked like, or what I wanted him to look like, or who I saw, and it was this guy I'd seen out at my farm town. I'd seen him twice, but then I finally found him again and I photographed him at the car wash.
Now, did you go up and
touch
his face?
No, I didn't tell him or anything. He doesn't know this. But I said, that's what I feel like the guy looks like, you know. And then the internalization, I mean, True Detective is probably one of the hardest jobs I've ever had to have to sit with, And I was really, I loved everyone I was working with. It was a great experience, but I just wanted that character off of me. I didn't want, and it took me a couple, a month or something to be like, all right, your kids are fine. But I have kids. I have a daughter and I have a son. And it was the easiest job I've ever done as far as acting. But it was the hardest job I ever had to do to sit with. Because, I mean, all I had to do was think about my two kids and what that would have been like to lose them. And so it made my job very easy to do the stuff, as well as Nick wrote some very poetic dialogue for me throughout the whole show, but Tom's stuff. But as far as like getting into character or any of that stuff, it was, I didn't have to work too hard on that. You know, it was something that just all, that's all I had to think about. I mean, my kids are the most important thing to me in my life. And the thought of losing them is like terrifying. Mahershala is really...
Mahershala Ali, sure.
Was very good to me. And he would do this thing at work where he would just come up to me and put his hands on me and stare at me in the eye for like a minute, minute and a half, just trying to soak in energy. And I sort of would take his energy from him, you know, and he just, and I didn't know what he was doing. I mean, I'm assuming that's what he was doing, was soaking in energy, but he could just, I don't know, there was some pain that I was really feeling a lot when I was there, and I feel like he was either coming over to either comfort me or coming over to just to help take that pain off of me or something.
What an amazing profession you have, that you're allowed to go there and explore that emotional side of yourself.
With no rules.
With no rules.
No rules. Nobody can tell you no. No one can, you know what I mean? No one, it's...
In a way, you can't really, I guess you could call something good or bad, but you can't really judge someone's process or the way they get there.
Yeah, I think that if it's, to me, I've always felt like, and look, I'm not always real, you know? I mean, that's what I think, whereas an actor, you're always striving for it to be real. And you have these moments where, okay, that felt real. And or you have these moments where, God, it just, it doesn't feel real, you know? And I think that, you know, yeah, we have this, I feel so blessed to work in an industry or have a job that your job is to pretend and play, you know, and you don't have to apologize. It makes the job so much fun. That's why I'm like, let's make mistakes. Don't try and make it perfect. Like, just, you know what I mean? If it's, if we fuck up, we'll do it again. You know what I mean? It doesn't need to be perfect. Michael Fassbender said something to me that I really took from him was, and I sort of thought this, but to hear him say it, realized how right he was, or like, you know, give me...
I gave you validation.
Validation is... whatever ideas that you come up with last night and you bring to work the next day suck. They were good last night when you were doing them last night and you were feeling the way you were feeling last night. But you've woken up today and you've had breakfast and a phone call or something that someone upset you on the way to work, a traffic, whatever. You're in a different place. So I don't like to plan anything the night before. Because whatever I planned the night before is probably, hopefully it's great, you know what I mean? But it doesn't mean it's going to be great tomorrow. Like, to me, if it's real, it's real. Like, you can't deny it. You know, you can't be, like, someone could say, hey, he sucks in that performance or he sucks in that movie. That's fine. As long as it's real, then that's just me. That's the character, and that's me portraying that character as real as I can, and it felt real to me, and it may have sucked, but I don't care.
I have to ask you, when you use your own personal experience or your own personal fears, how does that affect your reality? Like when you were on set all day doing those scenes in True Detective, and you'd go home and call your kids, or like, how was that a weird Like, does the character fight with the reality a little bit for you? And
yeah, I feel like, you know, God, irony is half the time I feel like I'm playing a character. I feel like my reality is, you know, is that saying that you don't become the character becomes you. Like, you don't have control of being this character, because if you're doing all these things, eventually this character will be becoming of you. And for me, I can't really have control over stopping that or not. Every role I do is, the reason I'm interested in the part or the character is because I see something in myself in that role.
So you really personalize it.
Everything's personalized. I don't know how to do it any other way. I can pretend certain elements of it, but like the root of the character or the root of the role, I got nothing to hold on to. I don't know anything that's familiar to root myself in it, you know? So every job or every character has, oh, I'm like that sometimes. And I may hate that I'm like that sometimes, but I'm like that sometimes. Like, I can't stand people that are entitled. But through a role, I'll realize, oh my God, like, I'm so embarrassed. I'm entitled about some things, you know? And so you, and doing it for, you know, I haven't been doing it that long, 10 years, 15 years, you sort of learn things about yourself. I've learned a lot about myself, and there's a lot of some stuff I think that are positive things, and I've learned stuff about myself that are negative things, but I've learned all those things, not through interaction with people. I've learned those things through sort of digging deep inside myself and finding fascinations with, you know, there was this producer that I worked with, and he had this eye, you know, and I know, knowing his past and his history, because I talked to him about it when I did Frank, I was trying to think of, like, who is this guy? And then it dawned on me, I'm like, oh, I know who this guy is now. So then I was thinking about this producer and his actions and the way he acts and stuff, and he's a great guy, good friend of mine. But you take that little thing, like the weird, the eye thing that he has, but then there's all these other parts of the character that that are personalized. So the exterior of that character was like, okay, this is who he is, and let me take pieces of this guy, but then I have to take something of myself to overlap it or mesh the two together, or otherwise I just feel like I'm lost. I feel like I'm just saying lines that have no meaning or weight or value to them, and I'm just a talking head.
Right.
And maybe I could do that, but then I get bored, and I don't want to get bored. I start twiddling my thumbs, and then I want to go play with the camera gear or go outside and dig through the dumpster at work and start trying to find stuff to salvage or start moseying around, and I just lose interest.
It sounds like you've chosen acting as a way to understand life.
Yeah, that's
right. And for self-awareness, right?
Yes, absolutely. And we change as we grow. And the way I thought about certain things 10 years ago is completely different the way I think about them now. So you can keep diving inside of yourself to sort of self-awareness and, you know, and dive into this one area where you can dive into it 3 years later and that area's changed. It's different.
Do you ever take the character out for a spin, so to speak, or you find yourself in a market or in a restaurant or something and you're going to try this person out to some unsuspecting checker or cashier or something?
It's more so I like my sort of take on it. I'll go out and sort of buy, usually at the thrift store, buy little pieces that I think that are the character, and I'll start wearing them around before I start the job. And I'll even sort of maybe cut my hair or do something or grow my facial hair out to sort of get an idea, to catch the character in the mirror. You know, when I'm brushing my teeth, I'm like, oh, it's okay, I'm trying this on. To start feeling it, to start seeing it, so that when you get there, you have a familiarity to it already.
Yeah. God, you know, I loved Halt and Catch Fire so much, and that's where I really became aware of you. But I think the reason that show really stuck with me is because I did feel like I was looking at real people.
Well, they took on Halt and Catch Fire, the pilot episode is him reverse engineering a computer,
right,
in the garage. I mean, immediately I connected to me as a kid, hanging out in the garage, taking apart electronics. And I think my daughter was just born. So I had the first sort of experience of what it was like to have a child. And in the show, you know, Gordon has two kids, you know what I mean? So the relationship between Donna and Gordon just felt, it felt real, you know what I mean? And working with Carrie and sort of the butting heads of the two characters was something that, you know, to go back to what you said, it was like, you know, me and Carrie would have these scenes where we'd be frustrated or arguing with each other, and then it felt like, you know, something about the baby, and then you feel like you would go home and, you know what I mean, you'd have a conversation with my wife about something, and it was just like, oh my God, like, I feel like I just had this conversation at work. Like, oh my God, where's the separation between the two of them, you know? And also, I grew up in the 80s, but I mean, I was younger, you know, because I was a 96 graduate from high school. But seeing the house, Donna and Gordon's house, was like the rugs, the blankets, the certain crap that was on the bookshelf. It was all the stuff that it was like going back in time and seeing all the stuff in my parents' house. And I just remember thinking, God, this is so bizarre. Like, that this feels so much like my home. I almost feel like my dad. And I remember when we were doing my hair, I wanted my hair to look like my dad's looked like in the 80s, and I wanted it to be matted to my head and have a perfect, this perfect sort of helmet to it, you know, so that when I caught myself in the mirror, I was like, oh, I'm my father. You know what I mean? That's the connectivity I had to that role, was I'm playing a version of my dad.
It's so interesting how you made up your own process to do this a lot of the way, or you found little bits and pieces. And I think what you describe about the way you take on characters and the way you connect with a role is by finding something within you. And you realize what a hard job acting can be in terms of, you can't hide from yourself. Like, you can't come to set and be like, I don't want to deal with me or whatever I'm dealing with.
It's easier to just take those feelings that are real and inject them into what you're doing that day.
Right.
And I know that a lot of people do that. They don't use personalized things. But for me, that seems like it would make my day so hard to constantly be imagining, and like it would just be so easier. Like, why don't I just make this real? It's about this, and this is the relationship I had with that person when I was in high school, or this person broke my heart, you know what I mean? I remember what that felt like. And that was the one thing that Susan Batson did say to us, is check in. Check in with yourself. As an actor, check in with yourself all the time. No matter what you're feeling, when you're happy, when you're sad, when you're mad, when you're angry, when you're frustrated, check in and see what your body's doing. See if it's turned over, see if it's lifted up, see what your posture's like, see what your hands do, see if you're tapping something. Check in all the time. And I did a lot of that, like in my 20s, was always checking in, seeing how I'm driving the car, what speed I go, you know what I mean? When I'm mad, when I'm happy, when I'm chill. And
literally trying to become self-aware.
Just self-aware, so that when I got to those places on a role or a job or that day, I already knew like the posture that he was sitting in, or I already knew what it feels like to be just devastated or just completely upset about you losing your kids. Like, how do you sit? How do you, you know, do you not want to look at people's faces? Do you want to turn away from them? Like, just being aware. And that's why maybe it's just easier for me, or more comfortable, to just make it real. Try and make it real. Like I said, it's not always real, you know what I mean? But that's what you're going for every
right.
day, you know.
But then occasionally you come across a job where it's a little too real, or
it's
hits close to home.
A little too real, yeah.
And you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
No, I still can't get over the picture of being on location, playing that role in True Detective, and having to talk to your kids. And
I had these Polaroids of my kids that I would tape up in the scenes. And you know, if I ever sort of didn't feel anything real, all I had to do was look down at that Polaroid.
Right.
And it would hit.
Is there anything that you can look at your early childhood, like if you look back and think of yourself as a kid down at the creek or whatever, is there any indicators of personality trait that makes sense that you're doing this now?
The locations. The places they send you for to go work on jobs you would never book a vacation.
Right.
You know, and I love being off the grid or just going to some town you would never go to, and the exploring of that, and the idea of, you know, getting your license when you're 16 and being able to go wherever you want. I find all that to be something from my childhood that I'm on the road. I'm headed somewhere, you know?
Well, listen, you were definitely headed somewhere. And I have enjoyed the ride of watching you work, and I really am a big fan. It's really interesting talking to you and just hearing the way you get to places. It's fascinating the way you've sort of found your way into this career, and you've built a really impressive body of original work. So
thank you. That's very, very kind of you to say, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to talk to you. I hope we go on a ride sometime and
twist the wrist.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thank you. This was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Hey, folks, that's our show. I love talking to Scoot. If you haven't seen Halt and Catch Fire, it ended a couple years ago, but it was such a great show. It was on AMC and it ran 4 seasons, and I highly recommend you check that out. Also, make sure to see him in True Detective. He is fantastic in that, and in Narcos, and in his new film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's an actor that's always going to surprise you, and I found him to be a totally charming and authentic human being to talk to as well. You know, we do this every week, and we've built up quite a number of episodes. This is episode 199. And if you haven't yet subscribed to this show, or if you're just discovering it, take a minute and go to iTunes and hit the subscribe button. That way, you'll never miss another episode. It'll just automatically show up in your podcast feed. And while you're there, if you leave us a rating and a review, it'll help other people find us. And that's a good thing, because we want to keep doing this show for as long as possible. And you may not know this, but we are also on television. That's right, Off Camera is on television. It's on every week. If you have DirecTV's Audience Network, we're on Monday and Wednesday nights, and then we repeat throughout the week. We shoot in glorious high-definition black and white, and it's a great way to take a deep dive into this show. So if you haven't yet seen what you've been hearing, make sure to check that out on DirecTV. If you don't have DirecTV, you can also find us through our subscription package through our website, offcamera.com. For only $4.99 a month, you can have access to every episode we've ever done. You can watch it on any device you want, and you can watch them as many times as you want. That's a great way to really binge watch the show and go deep into it and catch up on it. And it's also a great way if you're in any form of the arts, if you're an actor or a writer or a director or a painter or a musician or a photographer, the conversations we get into on this show really get to the heart of what it takes to pursue those professions. And I get valuable information with every guest that comes on the show, and I think that it's a great resource for anyone doing anything creative. So do yourself a favor, check out our subscription package, check out our whole website. There's a lot of fun stuff and ways to be involved with the show. Another way to be involved with the show is through social media. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I am Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram and Sam Jones on Twitter. If you follow me on Instagram or Twitter, you can also see a lot of behind-the-scenes pictures from what we do each week at the show. After we have our conversation, we go back into my photo studio and we do a portrait session with each artist that comes on the show. And it's a great way to sort of fill out the whole portrait. And you can see all these on our Instagram feed. So take a minute and check that out. And also, don't be shy. Tell your friends, tell your followers, tell everyone you can about Off Camera on social media. If you spread the word, we grow our audience, we can keep doing this for a long time. So if you like what we're doing, don't keep it a secret. Tell people about it. Give us guest suggestions. Talk about pieces of advice that you got or pearls of wisdom that made sense to you. Or just let us know what you're doing with your creative life. You can also get me on email. I'm sam@offcamera.com, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions. So lots of ways to connect. And as a kid who grew up listening to the radio and loved getting a perspective on the creative world that's out there beyond the reaches of my own home, I am continually amazed each week that I can do this show and that these words can reach so many people around the globe. And we've received letters from so many people, and it's so amazing when the job you do affects people in a personal and real way. So thank you so much for listening, and I hope you keep tuning in. And you have to tune in next time, because we have a very special guest to celebrate our 200th episode. And he was also our 5th episode ever, Robert Downey Jr.
First thing you learn in theater arts, aesthetic distance. I am not this play I'm doing. I'm not a character in The Fantastics. I'm not Will from Oklahoma. I'm not my work. And it sucks because, you know, the kid in all of us wants to be like, no, it's always going to be summer camp and we're all holding hands and singing Kumbaya, isn't it? It's like, no, snap out of it.
I wanted to have Robert back for a second time, not only because I love talking to him and because he's such an unexpected and surprising and beautiful creative mind, but also to publicly thank him for coming on this show at a time when it was a little tiny experiment in my old studio, and Robert agreed to come on the show, and at the time, that brought a lot of exposure to Off Camera and really sort of legitimized what we were doing. And, you know, it made me reflect on his own career and how he hit some real low points and he had times when he wasn't on top of the world. And Robert's one of those guys that sort of understands the whole journey, and it's fascinating to talk to him. So I wanted to have him back for the 200th episode to not only publicly thank him, but to dive back into his creative brain. I've worked with him several times since he came on for the last time, but one of the great things about this show is I realize I get to have a more in-depth conversation in front of the cameras on this program than I get to do in my real life with anybody. I mean, who takes the time to sit down for an hour plus conversation in our fast-paced world these days? And I got the chance to do that with Robert. I am really pleased with this episode, and I hope you'll join me next time to hear it. See you next time, off camera.